Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, Surviving the 21st Century, a look at health and nutrition in our modern world. As always, I'm joined by my very good friends, the writing and research team of Manny Barling and Ashley Brooks. It's good morning, because you're on the left coast. Good morning
to
both of
you. It is good morning on the left coast. I hope we catch up with you guys sooner or later.
We have. It's starting to rain.
Right. I normally, on the subject of rain, I normally start the program with, some piece of idiocy. But today I want to ask you a much more serious question. I'm in Mississippi, but about 10 miles away is the state line into Louisiana. And there's a good deal of talk at the moment about opening up the Morganza floodway to take some of the pressure off the Mississippi River, particularly between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. However, opening the Morganza floodway will actually flood 7 parishes in Louisiana. It's a really tough call to make. You know, do you intentionally flood areas, or do you let nature take its course? I'm just curious as to what your thoughts might be.
I can tell you, it's a decision I wouldn't want to make. And one of the problems with the decision is, you know, they did it in the early 70s, and when the population was far less. And that's one thing, but as the population increases, and we also have a situation where Louisiana has suffered as much as any state could possibly suffer because of BP, this is going to be insult to injury. But if you don't do it there, what are you going to do? Let it wipe out New Orleans? Because it will have a dramatic effect on New Orleans. And
right.
I think that's the really difficult decision that everybody has to deal with. And I wouldn't want to make it. It's just very difficult. And I want to add one thought. The track record of the Army Corps of Engineers is far better in foreign countries under the threat of war than it has been in the United States dealing with such simple issues, and maybe they're not simple as the New Orleans levees. And as a result, I just really worry because their decisions during Katrina were horrible. They were horrible.
Indeed. But, you know, someone has to make that call. I'm really glad it's not me. And I'm also glad I'm not downstream of, the Morganza floodway.
One of the pictures that they had, and I don't know, we haven't seen anything more here, or at least I haven't, where one of the newscasters, he's probably been fired since for showing this, was taking a boat along the Mississippi River, took a big pitcher, shoved it in the water, and said the biggest problem right now is that the river is filled with pesticides, sewage.
And diesel.
Diesel.
Right.
So the
big issue is that this water has to go somewhere. And guess where it's going to go? Lake Pontchartrain, which they've spent years cleaning up.
That was going to my point is that when it does hit these areas, it's literally going to carry tons of these contaminants. So whatever is growing in these areas will not be growing now. It's just going to kill off everything in sight.
Yeah. It makes me angry, but I don't know what the solution is.
You know, I'm watching the news, Simon, I feel the same way, and I feel so horrible and so badly for people right now who have had their homes destroyed. I always go back to us losing our home in the earthquake. We do understand. And it's and the fact that this their homes are filled with this toxic water is even worse. I mean, they almost are going to have to go in with, I feel, hazmat suits to clean up their homes when they get done.
Well, I don't think they'll be allowed back in. And for people to understand, we lived in a part of Santa Monica during the Northridge earthquake that didn't get much publicity. But we lived in an area, unbeknownst to us, had been a riverbed at one time, so it immediately liquefied into alluvial soil. And suddenly our house literally jumped, I would estimate, 6 inches in the air, slammed back down the ground, and shattered bolts, everything that held our foundation together. So the house literally moved, twisted, you know, about 3 inches sideways. The second floor started to droop like someone had dropped a 2,000-pound boulder in the middle, and it was bending. And suddenly every step was a creak like a bad movie where you thought you were going to fall through to the underlying floor. So even though we haven't experienced this extreme water damage, I can tell you the feeling of hearing your floor go...
Or the loss of the memories of the things in the house. That's where I'm a girl.
We'll go to there, too. Our, you know, much like I see these photos and I get chills, Simon, we walked into our kitchen, and you couldn't because it was under, I estimate, 6 to 8 inches of broken glass, china, you name it. Everything of any value to Ashley was just basically on the floor. And worse, the cupboard's empty, so it's full of salad oil. You had trouble picking up a piece of glass because it was so oily. So in the area that we lived, there'd never been any kind of earthquake, and I used to say, gee, you know, I'm glad I don't live in the valley anymore. I don't have to deal with earthquakes. Well, it turned out that I did have to deal with them, which was unexpected for anyone who lived in that area. So, yeah, we understand this, and we understand what these people are facing. The difference is we had no time to think about it, and in some respects, that's better. These people are sitting there thinking about, oh, my God, what am I going to do next? And that has just got to be torture.
Yes. Yeah. You know, natural disasters are that. They're natural. They're about to engineer a man-made disaster.
Right. But at the same time, we say this sometimes in Los Angeles, why are you building these large homes on hillsides that are subject to these kind of dangers? And we, you know, people who live here ask this question out loud all the time, like, what are you doing?
Oh, yeah, right above us? I wouldn't want one of their homes. They've got these massive homes up on stilts, on part of it's on the stilt, and if the earthquake hits, they're going to be the first ones to go down the hill.
Yeah,
I like being on solid ground. I had my lesson.
In 1972, I was sitting in my office in Century City. I was fortunate enough at that time in my law clear to have a office in what's called the Century Towers, which is a triangular buildings. And I had a nice office. I faced downtown L.A. On the left, when I looked to the right, I could see the beach. And it was absolutely wonderful until I was sitting there one evening about 6 o'clock and we had an earthquake and I could see the building kind of moving left to right, and then it was shifting because the building was built on rollers to protect it from an earthquake. And, gosh, I wish I had had a seatbelt for it. And suddenly you realize that no matter what you do, it's not enough. And to the people who are living in this area, who it's the one thing if you've been there for generations, your family have had a farm for 50 million years, but to move there in face of that, I think, is a great risk.
Oh, huge risk. Okay, I'll tell you what, let's move on. I'm sure that you have an announcement or two for us.
Well, actually, I just wanted to plug our favorite charity, which is the Recovering Soldiers in Washington. This week, I should probably suggest we all send a thank you to the fort in Kentucky that houses our special forces, especially SEAL Team 6. And I think about 30 million, 50 million thank you cards to these soldiers who eliminated Osama bin Laden would be a wonderful idea. But our American soldiers who have been injured really need a card. So send a Get Well card to Veteran, a Recovering Soldier, care of Walter Reed Army Medical Center, 6900 Georgia Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C. The zip is 20307. These soldiers need to know how much we care about them, and they will enjoy your card. Once a week when I'm doing my bills, I pull out a thank you card. I sign both Ashes in my name and a brief note saying thank you for everything you've done for us, and I send it. And it takes me, oh, I don't know, 1 minute, 2 minutes to do. And so once a week I send one out my bills, and I think it's a wonderful idea for every American.
And for those who pray, please remember them in your prayers. I think that these boys coming home really need our support through prayer, too.
I agree with you.
So, Simon, have you seen any of this news about Medicare and Social Security running out of money? I mean, all these politicians are standing in front of microphones, and Kathleen Sebelius, who's the head of Secretary for Health and Human Services, went to the Treasury and with her Social Security Administrator, Mike Astrew, and Labor Secretary Solis, and started saying, we're going to run out of money by 2024, and we're going to run out of Social Security by 2034. And, of course, immediately the Republicans offered all their solutions, the Democrats offered all their solutions, and this was sort of an announcement to the American public that, guess what, we're going to screw you. We're going to take away your money. We're going to do something to hinder and change the programs that we have. And I we had a brief conversation, and I'd like you to talk to us about what Medicare means to some of your family members and give it a real practical spin before we talk about some of the issues. So jump in, Simon.
Okay. It's my opinion that if you have paid into the system for your working life, you deserve to get some credit once you retire. My wife's parents are older. Her mother is on oxygen 24 hours a day. Her father is having trouble with his eyes. But they're independent souls, don't get me wrong here, you know, and they're not looking for anything, but they're on a fixed income. Guess what? If they go to the doctor, their copay is $40. Now, $40 might not sound a huge sum of money, you know, if you're earning $100,000 a year, but trust me, you know, if you're surviving on, you know, your pension, it's a huge sum of money. And I had a conversation with her dad. And he was incensed that the doctor wanted him to come in or his wife to come in, you know, twice a month rather than once a month. And he's saying, well, that's just double my bill. And it's a bill I already can't pay. And yeah. You know, never mind the cost for medication and the rest of it. A little bit's covered, but a huge amount of it isn't covered. And these folks worked their entire life in good faith, and now they're being treated so shabbily. It makes me want to scream.
They can't defend themselves either, which means that who are you going to pick on? So if you've got a bully in the White House, that's how I view it. Okay, guys, that's my opinion, is that if you've got somebody who's a bully in the White House, what are they going to pick on? The guy who can't stand up for himself.
Well, in all fairness, this is not the policies of Obama. This is a Republican government, a portion of our government, who are trying basically to enforce some type of legislation through cutting monies. And you have to listen to what they're saying. The basic announcement goes something like this, and I wrote it down. The faltering Medicare finances, caused in part by the sluggish economy, are expected to intensify pressure on both parties in Washington to move forcefully to shore up the health plan that covers care for more than 47 million elderly and disabled Americans. The slow economic recovery, which has depressed payroll taxes, worsened the program's fiscal outlook this year, is the cause, okay? So then House Speaker John Boehner says, for decades, politicians in Washington, D.C. have looked up at the size and scale of the fiscal challenges facing our country, particularly in Medicare, and chosen to kick the can down the road. Today's trustees report is another reminder that we've run out of road. Well, time out here. First of all, Simon, in answer to what you said, they're putting off penalizing anybody who's 55 years older by timing their changes to the 2020s in hopes that we'll all die off. That if I live to 2024, 2022 or 2024, I'll have to start paying some share of my Medicare, which they estimate to be about $12,000 per person a year. Well, most people don't earn that much money net after their Social Security, because out of your Social Security these days, you have to pay for your Medicare. I pay $182 a month for my Medicare. So besides paying the $182, I'd have to spend $1,000 a month out of my pocket for medical treatment. For families on fixed incomes, especially the people older than me who worked during the 50s and early 60s when salaries were so much lower, this is a slap in the face. So even that period of time is too short to protect this group. And why are they doing it? Because they're afraid of the vote from the AARP, and they also don't want to penalize their peer groups because so many members of Congress are 55 to 75. So what do they do? Go home to their friends, say, I just screwed you on Medicare, to their contingents? So what they're saying is, I'm not going to mess with anyone my age or older, but these generations behind me, Gen X and all of this, I never liked them anyway, so screw them. We'll just take the money away. We'll make them deal with it because guess what? We don't like them anyway. And, Simon, that's one of the big problems. So throwing that in, if your in-laws are successful enough to live, say, 90, let's say they reach 90, and it's now in the 2020s, so you may have someone 90 years old, may need to be in assisted living, who's now being told his Medicare is being cut back, and they've got to spend at least $1,000 a month out of their own pocket for medical care, plus the cost of assisted living. And that's what's in store if we allow our government to continue to walk down this road.
Okay, where I get hung up, and maybe I shouldn't, is why is everything involved with the medical industry so damned expensive? I've seen the exposés on CNN by Dr. Sanjay Gupta, you know, about how it's, you know, $3,000 for a ballpoint pen. I mean, why is there no cost control?
Well, because the industry doesn't want one. And it's not the doctors. I'll give an example. There was a series of video articles I saw, one on CBS, about how they should cut back giving CAT scans and MRIs on young children because of the dangers of children. But why are they doing it? They're doing it for income. And if they start cutting back on these tests, then these $5-7 million MRI machines can't be paid for. So I know some doctors who put one in the office, and of course they couldn't operate their own, so they had to have a company run by someone else and had to be another doctor who wasn't treating patients so he could legally own one. And so now all these doctors, to keep the MRI in their medical building, are having to send patients there to justify its existence, so they have an in-house one in the building, which means that each one's got to prescribe more MRIs. And in the hospital setting, I can tell you, every month a hospital generates a report to doctors showing what's called utilization. I have a doctor friend who provides 24% of a census in a major hospital in Los Angeles. He's someone who treats a lot of elderly patients. They just about put the red carpet out for him every time he walks in. But they watch his ancillaries, x-ray, everything else, to make sure that he's prescribing enough of those to keep those facilities going. So the doctors, as I describe in our book, are the horses that pull the wagon, and administrators and the corporations are sitting in that wagon chair beating them with a whip to produce more results. And that's one of the reasons so much testing and so much money being spent. Ashley, you've spent a lifetime in this industry, and your mother was in this industry, so tell us about your experiences with testing and excess dollars.
Oh, I was sitting here just listening to you, Manny, thinking my mind was going all over the place. And one of them was, I think a fine example is even on surgeries. I went to two different places. First of all, before I go there, I think what I'm looking at with Medicare, I keep going back to when Ronald Reagan came in and said, you know, families can take care of their own. So therefore, we don't need to take care of any of these psychiatric patients anymore. The mess it has made and the horrible impact it has had on the people who are mentally ill, the people who are out on the street who are mentally ill, the families who have been burdened by this, and it's not burdened because, oh my gosh, this person is mentally ill, I don't want to take care of it. People cannot take care of people. I know, because I lived in a house where my sister was given LSD at a party. She was retarded. And someone apparently thought it was funny to see somebody trip out that was retarded, and it turned her into a full-blown schizophrenic during this time that Reagan did this. Now, the impact that it had on our entire family, with a sister who was so mentally ill that she tried to murder me, she tried to murder my dad, she was flipping out at any time, and the impact it had socially just on my family. Now, you take that and you multiply that out on what's happening now with Medicare. What is the plan? Let everybody's family take care of them who can't even financially support themselves. A lot of the kids don't have jobs now. A lot of the kids can't support themselves. Kids as in, you know, people who are going to be the children of those elderly. I mean, I'm looking at the numbers going, 47 million elderly and disabled. So what are we going to do, kick them out on the street like Reagan did with the mentally ill? I mean, it's just not a system that can work unless we Americans get behind to continue to support. It's just, to me, realizing where we need to spend our dollars, and it certainly isn't building schools in another country rather than building schools in our own country. It isn't sending jobs out to another universe when we need it here. I mean, so that's where I go with all this, Manny.
Let me ask you a question, Ashley. You are a registered nurse. I don't think you practice any longer. It seems to me that nurses are not terribly well paid in the grand scheme of things.
That's an understatement.
Yeah, and it's better than it used to be. And there's a lot more respect going towards nurses, although it's tough. But there is more respect, and more demand is going on, heavier education with nurses, which is a very good thing. And so I think there's a shift going on there. But I think that there's a lot of other people that need to be paid more. I think that our soldiers need to get paid more. I think that our firemen need to get paid more. Our police need to get paid more. I think that there is a difference, and teachers have to get paid more. I mean, so that's a whole different ballgame when we're talking about who's getting paid what. And I don't know how the system is going to change.
But I guess where I'm headed with this is the escalating health care costs are not necessarily anything to do with the cost of manpower. It's elsewhere.
Yeah, it's in the equipment, and it's in what they charge. I'll give an example. There's an item called a Coulter counter that just irritates me. I used to buy them all the time with clients when we equipped laboratories. In the 70s, they basically sold for about $35,000, which is no small amount of money for what's essentially a mini computer. And, of course, the argument at the time was, well, we have to amortize our costs. Well, that's now 35 years later, and guess what? It's selling for way over $100,000 now, but it's basically the same machine. They've done literally nothing to it. So they're now selling a machine for over $100,000 that is basically amortized. I'm not even sure its patent hasn't run out. So at the end of the day, people are paying more because, like oil, they can. So in a market where someone may create something new that nobody has, then they overcharge. And one of the other things that's being put into this is this quote that drives me nuts from Timothy Geithner, who's the head of the Treasury. Americans are living longer, and health care costs are continuing to rise. And we do not do more to contain the rate of growth in health care costs, then our commitments will become unsustainable. We have pointed out for a long time that the Americans who are living longer are the Depression of World War II generation. I can tell you my generation in their 60s are not living longer because every day I pick up the obituary column in Los Angeles and see someone I know or someone I've done business with my age. I see rock stars. I see members of bands. I see scientists of every persuasion, one form of cancer or another, complications of diabetes, kidney transplants, liver transplants, and the litany of illness and disease facing our country, which we discuss at length in all of our books and blogs, is shortening this generation. Do you think we had Generation X? Well, this one, new one, we should call Generation F for fat. You think these obese teenagers you see all over television are going to live to 60, 70, 80, eating McDonald's and other food like that and packaged pizzas? Ashley, do you think they're going to live that long?
No. In fact, the blog that we had put out this week on the statistics, I think, says a lot. And I don't know if I have that, Manny, because I think these statistics are important while we're doing Medicare because people need to realize what the statistics are. They go, oh, well, people are living longer. Well, let's see. Every 25 seconds, an American will have a coronary event, while about one every minute will die from one. 26.6 million adults, 12% of adults in the United States, have heart disease, resulting in 16 million annual visits to the doctor with heart disease as a primary diagnosis. We go on to cancer. This year, about 569,490 Americans are expected to die of cancer. 1,500 people a day are dying of cancer in the United States. It is the second largest cause of death in the United States, exceeding heart disease. You have the $20.9 billion will be spent on indirect morbidity, cost of loss of productivity to cancer. $108.2 billion will be spent on direct medical costs, total of health expenditures. In 2010, $263.8 billion was the overall cost of cancer.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because one of the themes of our books and blogs is if we cut out the problems of cancer, diabetes, and other illnesses by improving our foods, getting rid of all the genetically modified foods and factory farm meats and all these chemicals like MSG, then we could save $100 million a year, maybe as much as $1 billion a year in medical costs. Because if we reduce heart attacks by 20%, cancer by 20%, and diabetes across the board, I can't even estimate the amount of money that would be saved by that over a period of time.
And there covers the Medicare to cover the elderly. I mean, the elderly, they can't defend themselves, for Pete's sake. Let's go pick on them. That's not fair. And, you know, one of the things, too, many you were saying about children, these stats were startling to me. 11% of children aged 2 to 5 years old are overweight. 11%.
Well, honey, let's come back to overweight in a moment. Let's
Okay.
Start with the Medicaid for Medicare.
Okay.
You know, the House Republicans last month approved a plan that would effectively privatize Medicare in 2022. And then they would give seniors vouchers. Oh, yeah. Can you imagine turning over Medicare and Medicaid to Blue Cross? I had a tumor in my eye, okay? It was blinding me in the left eye. It stuck out so far, I looked like a cyclops. I mean,
it was pretty ugly.
ugly. And it was causing me vision problems, so I had it surgically removed. You know what they told me? They said, the Blue Cross said it wasn't an essential and required surgery and that I didn't need it. You know, and I've had multiple cancerous tumors taken out of me, and now all of a sudden I have a tumor behind my eye that could cause me to go blind. So I had to fight them, and if I weren't a lawyer, I would have never been paid back for it. And it was a $3,000 surgery, I might add. So at the end of the day, that means every senior gets a voucher. We have to have something done medically. It gets rejected by the insurance company that runs private Medicare. So what do they do? In California, Kaiser Permanente, who's a big insurance carrier, is notorious. If you have a malpractice or claim problem with them, you have to go to the private arbitration staffed by their own private arbiters. So guess what? You think you're going to get a fair shake when Blue Cross sends you to an arbitration where the arbitrator is paid by them and part of their company? Oh, wow. I don't think Americans have to guess what the outcome will be. So what it does is allows the Republican government and others in the government to basically eliminate you in a different way. And I don't want to limit them. And by the way, Ashley's comments about Ronald Reagan, my Republican friends always tell me that Jimmy Carter did it, even though the facts prove otherwise. And I had lunch with one of my more extreme right-wing Republican friends recently, and somehow or another, when the sun didn't rise last week, it was the Democrats' problem. And that underlies the problem we're having in Congress now. There is no middle ground. With the Tea Party and all these other people jumping into the fray, we've alienated this country much the way the Missouri Compromise did in 1830. There's no middle ground. You're either on one side of this issue or on the other, which means we're not going to have a solution. What we're going to have is an ongoing fight. And that also worries me. So as a private independent budget group determined, 44 million Americans, all of them seniors, would lose Medicare coverage and almost an equal amount of number of Medicaid coverage. Well, if you add that up, that's basically everybody in the country. But those numbers are based on future population. And when they say, and this is what they said, the federal government would save billions of dollars in large part by shifting and increasing the share of medical costs onto seniors who would pay almost twice as much out of their own pockets or more than $12,500 a year in 2022. Does anyone listening to this show know a senior citizen that can afford to spend $12,510? So my Medicare is going up every year, so assume by 2022 it's going to cost me $250 to $300 a month if I'm alive. That means the average American senior will put out $16,000 to $17,000 a year in Medicare, and God help him if he has to have surgery or something radical.
Especially once the control goes back to the insurance companies. Isn't that right, Manny?
Yeah.
That's what would happen. And what, for example, with me, with the Blue Cross, I used Blue Cross 3-4 years ago for one MRI that I needed. They wanted to do a test on something. We were paying everything out of the pocket so that my insurance wouldn't go up. My insurance is, what is it, $750 per month. They triple-dippled it, and it's...
No, it's more than that. It's $900.
$900 a month for us who...
No, you.
For me alone, and it's because the insurance company is allowed to increase whatever they want because I dared to use my insurance 4 years ago for one thing, and before that, I hadn't used it in 20 years. So they are permitted to do this. What do people think are going to happen if they allow this Medicare to be put back into the hands to, oh, let's give the senior a voucher? Do you think that Jan's parents could take that voucher and walk it anywhere in their current state to get any kind of insurance that they would need?
Well, it's funny. Let's go a step farther. Why don't we just give big oil control over controlling oil? BP might as well just make all the decisions about cleanups, everything else, because that's what you would have with medicine if you turned it over to Blue Cross and the other businesses. And part of what bothers me are these riders that the conservative Republicans demand on the health care bill. One of them is, the new health care law includes a series of cuts to hospitals and other medical providers designed to spur increased efficiency. I don't hear drug companies, instrument makers, and other things, and capital equipment included in there. Why don't they lean on drug companies to reduce the cost of drugs a reasonable amount? Why don't they lean on the manufacturer's x-rays machines where they're making a fortune making the same equipment over and over? You know why? Because they spend millions of dollars every day lobbying our Congress to prevent them from being included in this bill. Billy Thompson, who's a former senator from Louisiana, is notorious. He represents the drug companies. He uses the inner sanctum of Congress to use the gym, the private quarters, everything, to visit his buddies, and is paid a fortune by the drug companies to influence legislation. After Obama slammed him during his election, he welcomed to the White House and then made a deal to sold seniors out on Medicare, where they're not getting any breaks at all in medicine. I buy my medicine in Canada, and I pay less for medicine shipped to me from Canada, including the shipping charges, than if I bought it through Medicare.
Plus, it's not filled with inert excipients and all the things that were making you sick.
And by the way,
you're getting sick on the medicine.
And by the way, the medicine in Canada, made from the same patents and owned by companies in partnership with the same manufacturers in America, make a pure, better product than what's done in America.
It's allowed in America.
Yeah.
You're only allowed, you know, tons of excipients in it and things that make people sick, which end up costing this country more money based on more hospitalization. It's like, wait a minute, how can we get this back under control?
So, Simon, have you and Jan picked up drugs for your father-in-law and mother-in-law? Have you seen what they cost?
It's an arm and a leg. I mean, it's frightening.
Simon, my Blue Cross, when I pay for this Blue Cross, does not cover my medicine.
Oh,
yeah.
Lord.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you a funny thing. Walgreens in my neighborhood offers a discount to seniors, and most seniors who buy drugs abroad will tell you that certain drugs, which are triplicates, at least in the state I live, like Vicodin and higher levels of Tylenol, et cetera, cannot be purchased abroad because of controlled substances. Well, if I use my Medicare card and I go to CVS Pharmacy and all the rest, they want a bloody fortune for a simple Vicodin prescription. If I go to Walgreens and just show my license, tell them I'm a senior, they sell it for 25 to 30% less than if I use my Medicare card at many different pharmacies. So even within that framework, it is so weird and strange. It all depends on where you buy. But in the end, you're getting screwed. It's the bottom line.
Well, what bothers me is that a drug manufacturer can come up with a, quote, wonder drug. I mean, we've seen thousands or at least hundreds of these over the past, two, three decades. Yes, I understand that they put in a certain amount of, research and all the rest of it, but why charge $10 a tablet? I'm sure that, that they could sell it for $1 a tablet and still more than cover their manufacturing costs.
At $10 a tablet, Ashley had a very unusual infection a year or so ago that required some new antibiotic that, frankly, we'd never heard of. And it was really new in the market, very high tech. And my recollection was that was over $100 a pill. I was able to order it in Canada, and I bought it for one-third the cost of what they were selling it here in the United States. So my point is that the truth is...
Wasn't $100 a pill? I don't remember how much it was. It was expensive, though. It was very expensive.
It was $50 a pill, and it was like $10 a pill in Canada.
Right.
But
there was a huge difference.
But, my point is that things are selling cheaper elsewhere, but they're not selling cheaper here. And that alone I find upsetting. Why is it Canadians can buy American drugs in Canada cheaper than Americans can buy American drugs in America?
Same with Europe. There's a lot of medicines that are available in Europe. And that's a shame because it gets back to our issue of how can this country save money? How about doing equally what you're doing in medicine alone? How many billions of dollars it would come into this country because people wouldn't be going elsewhere to buy their stuff? I mean, it's that much more money that economically goes into our economy.
Yeah, and I want to come back to another thing, too, statistically. Well, one of the points I was going to make earlier, and I basically miss, is all the scare over Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security is really premature. we are having a downtime in our economy. It's gone on for 3 years. It's not going to go on forever. At the same time, in my life, the population of the United States has gone up 50, 60 million people, and maybe more. And in the next 15 to 20 years, by 2030, it's going to be over 400 million people. Well, at the same time, this generation of children will be adults, and we are going to have probably an increased workforce by 25 to 30% of the amount of Americans working now. In that case, then both Medicare and Social Security will be increased in terms of the deposits by the increased number of people, even if they earn less. And if we don't have jobs for those people, and they're not generating money for Medicare and for Social Security, again, we have a problem that is far greater than what we're discussing today, because we can't afford to have 50, 60 million people out of work in another depression. And
with all the elderly on the street, because they'll just become like the street people.
In the Depression of the 30s, there was approximately 36 to 38 million Americans out of work, a huge number in that population. But to this day, if we had 36 million Americans out of work, it would be the largest catastrophe in the history of the country. So, Simon, do you have any reflections on those numbers?
Oh, the whole thing horrifies me. And, you know, you're saying, okay, the working population may increase 25 to 30%, but you also have to understand that doorways and cubicle size will have to increase because everyone's overweight.
Absolutely. And if not, they're all going to die sooner. And in that case, Medicare is going to be relieved by the fact that people are dying prematurely.
So maybe now's a good time to do the statistics that we put together
please.
With the obesity.
And let's talk about this generation that's becoming so obese.
So 11% of the children in the United States, specifically United States, ages 2 to 5 years old, are overweight. 15% of the children, ages of 6 to 11 years old, are overweight. 18% of the adolescents aged 12 to 19 years old are overweight. 10 million children are either overweight and obese. Obese children have a 70% chance of becoming obese adults. The percentage increases to 80% if either one or both of the parents are obese as well. 85% of all children in the United States cannot pass a basic physical fitness test. 85%. 40%, now this one I really want to underscore, 40% of 12-year-old children display heart disease factors, obesity, hypertension, high cholesterol, and inactivity. 68% of adults aged 20 years and over are overweight or obese. One-third of them are diagnosed as clinically obese. Those statistics are phenomenal because we're looking at not only the current generation, we're looking at the younger generation, and we're looking at the future generation and how that is going to impact. I mean, we're all so busy talking about the Medicare thing. You know, the focus needs to be put back on the prime thing, which is prevention.
Oh, wait a minute, honey. Your Big Mac supersize is ready for you. You want to jump in?
Oh, let me have that ammonia burger. I can smell it from here.
So, you know, basically everyone who's doing that is just shortening their life every day.
And it isn't just that, Manny. It's as we talk about with the factory farming and the genetically engineered. There are right now more than 200. So this doesn't even go into the stats we talked about. There are more than 200 known diseases that are transmitted through our food. Do you know how many billions of dollars in the 90s, foodborne illnesses in the late 90s, because I can't find the current stats, it cost this country $36 billion a year for foodborne illnesses. But there's no, I can't find the amount of money for now, and I'm sure that's going to take a lot of digging. And Simon, if you come up with it, that would be great. But, you know, look at that.
The statistic I would love to find is a comparison on obesity rates from, let's say, 1960, you know, 40 years ago.
Well, there weren't any raids because there wasn't any. Nobody
right.
even thought about it. You know,
right.
having
nope.
grown up and gone to school here, I can only, and I thought about a lot of this while we were writing. There was only one girl in my entire class to be considered overweight, and there weren't really any boys who were overweight in my class. And it just really didn't exist. Nobody thought about it. In fact,
right.
I comment, and I think I've said it to you once or twice, that one of the things I notice when I watch these older movies is that nobody's overweight.
You know, it's really frightening. We're on according to our clock, it's 10:44. That means for 44 minutes now, we have been speaking. And this means one every minute, people will die from a heart disease. 44 people, while we have spoken, have died from coronary heart disease.
Wow.
Yeah.
And every 25 seconds, an American will have a coronary event, which doesn't include that number I just gave. 45 people just died of coronary disease. When you start putting in a perspective of this, the prevention of what we have to do as a country, that's where the money needs to be put, because that money will go back into our pockets, back into the health of a nation that makes us a lot more productive. You're not losing people every day to productivity because they're sick. And then we can take care of the elderly. I mean, since when did we become a cold nation that the first thing you're going to kick out of bed are the old folks?
Oh, I think that's been on the board for at least 10 years, probably
yes.
longer.
I think so too, Simon. It's very sad to me, very, very sad.
Manny, yeah. you were talking about, you know, your school experience. Mine was very similar. I went to an all-male grammar school. I think there were something like 350 kids that attended, and that there was maybe one guy with the name of Fatso, and that was it.
You know, not to interrupt you, Mandy, but geez, you know, Simon, you're right. Even in my class, it was in my sister's class. And he was retarded, and he had he wore glasses, and he was obese, and he was the only person in all of the school that was obese.
Yeah, and to go a step farther, as we point out frequently in our books, even McDonald's was basically organic at the time, because there weren't all these chemicals and junk in the food. So you could eat a McDonald's without dying. And my generation liked McDonald's. And although I stopped eating it in college for a number of reasons, one of which is I was broke and starving in college. And McDonald's in the old days, when I started college in 1962, was basically 37 cents you could get a McDonald's fries and a Coke. Well, for 74 cents a day struggling through college, I was able to feed myself. But don't ask me to ever eat it again. So I the last time I had it was coincidentally the day of the Northridge Ridge earthquake, because they were the only place in Santa Monica that was open. And, of course, the Northridge earthquake happened at 4:30 a.m. on a Sunday night, or Monday morning, actually, and nobody was prepared for it, so we hadn't had time to go shopping, anything. Whatever food was in our refrigerator was immediately thrown on the ground, so you know, being able to buy food or have something to eat on that day was really a nightmare. My son spent several hours in line at McDonald's to be able to get that. So, but anyway, the bottom line to all of this is that things have changed. They've changed because the quality of food has changed.
Right. And when did this change really start? I want to say the early 90s, but
well,
I could be wrong.
It's funny, I just read an article, I was doing some research for our new book, and I read an article, several of them, by the way, that various authors have pinpointed ground zero as 1996, when basically Monsanto introduced genetically modified foods. A lot of writers treat that the same as dropping the nuclear bomb in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So to many people in the food industry, that's ground zero. And even though there was MSG before that, MSG on its own didn't seem to have as many detrimental problems as it did in combination with these other foods. So that's just the opinion of some of the other writers in the area.
I'm curious. You said 96. I actually thought that it had its roots a couple of years earlier.
It did.
Maybe 1992,
93. It did. But the people are trying to pinpoint it down, and that's what they're saying is 96.
Well, I'm
but actually, with genetically engineered food did start back then.
But it wasn't widely in use until 96, and
right.
That's why they...
They're using that, yes.
And that's when the GMO wheat, soy, corn, et cetera, really started to expand, and that was the beginning of the problem, according to them. I go both ways with it. I think this food has been a problem for some time, and perhaps that was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Combined with CAFOs, factory farming. And
right.
Because the factory, I think, and I'm not sure about this, Simon, so don't quote me on it, the genetically engineered feed may still have been fed to the cattle during that time period, and I think that's kind of, no, it's not, Manny?
No, they didn't start doing that until it was actually approved for use. You have to remember that none of this was approved until Michael Taylor took over the FDA as assistant commissioner and ushered in genetically modified foods. In fact, I've written a blog with a history of this that I think you're going to put up and publish the end of next week. So I went to a lot of trouble to outline and look at this history. And, yes, there are people who feel that there were events that significantly affected it earlier.
Yes.
But really, it's here. You can't avoid it. It's in your face time. Occurred when the GMOs were finally approved.
Okay. GMO... started in the very early 90s, but it took until, 96 to get wide acceptance? Is that what you were saying?
No, I'm saying it wasn't completely approved by the FDA, and it had stalled, and the solution was to bring in Michael Taylor out of, who was Monsanto's lawyer, and he was appointed to a position in the FDA, and he was a deputy commissioner, and he pushed through genetically modified foods. So while there had been testing with the GMO corn, and some of them had been used in various tests and had been used in some CAFOs in some areas, it was not the wide use that people attribute to it. That didn't come until the official approval. In fact, the initial stuff wasn't done until Bush took office the initial stuff was done during George Bush Sr.'s time when all of this was basically proposed, and then it stalled under Clinton. So it took some activity to get it back up and going again.
Because they were reporting back in 1986 that there were problems with the biotech food.
Well, and let's put it where it is. The FDA scientists were going crazy because they didn't want it approved, and they were issuing reports saying that it should be tested, you can't do this.
And that there were problems. They saw problems back then.
Right.
According to Dr. Ho, May Ho, she said that these problems were reported in 1986.
So at the end of the day, despite all these complaints by employees of the FDA, basically, Michael Taylor issued a statement that effectively said that there's no information or proof that there's any negative statements about, GMOs, when in fact there had been so many negative statements made by their own employees. It was amazing. So what I would really call a cover-up and the big lie to the American public. And in Europe, they weren't accepting it. They're saying that we're not going for this because we know it's not true. And since then, Monsanto's been in a battle with the European governments that's going on even today about forcing the GMO foods into Europe. I found in WikiLeaks, I was reading a lot of WikiLeaks documents, a document from the Bush administration to the embassy in Paris instructing them on how to pressure the French government into forcing them to allow GMOs to be used in France. And basically the French government literally refused. And since then, there's been a battle between the French government and American government over this issue, because I think they were greatly offended, like the Canadians were, about these actions. So that's how it all started, and since then, the battle's on. And speaking of that, I want to point out that Sweden recently passed some laws in the last week or so, and they believe they will be totally GMO-free in the coming year. So these countries are not moving towards GMOs. They're moving away from them.
Yeah, because their studies keep coming up the same thing, that there is a serious problem with the genetically engineered food. And again, I think France, we had a conversation last night about France and what's going on with France. You may want to talk about that.
Well, yeah, you know, basically, and this is my opinion, lawyer and as a historian, that when I look at the battle in France, you know, anyone who's watched France, the battle going on GMO foods and the battle between France, the United States, and a wider number of issues. One of the things that I find extremely interesting is that those of us who have grown up, and you growing up in England have watched French politics a lot, I'm sure. That the French are kind of quirky and strange. We had problems with De Gaulle, as in the United States. We had a number of disagreements. He would retaliate. He basically ignored the American government when it suited him. But at the same time, France was the only country in the world that repaid their war debt to the United States in full. So criticize them or not, they're the only ones who have done that. But at the same time, because of that, they reject pressure from the United States. Well, something has gone wrong in the relationship between France and the United States that now has become personal. And they can say what they want, and our government can say, gee, I don't think that's possible. But I think any rational person watching what's going on can see that. So at the end of the day, our relationship's getting worse, and some of it seems to be involved with this constant pressure by Monsanto to have their products used in that country. So at the same time that we're struggling around the world getting assistance from countries of the world on touchy areas like Iraq, et cetera, we're trying to force policies on them that they don't want. So the food policies of Monsanto, in my opinion, and the opinion of others, is starting to dramatically affect the relationship of the United States with other countries. It happened in Spain. The United States government, under Bush, tried to pressure Spain to adopt GMOs, and they really put pressure on them. It's not like, gee, we want you to do it. What they're doing is threatening they will get no loans from the World Bank. Oh, gee, that's a wonderful way to breed a good relationship with a country.
And what I really respect for these European countries is their absolute humanity, because to me, Manny, this is about humanity. This is about a human being's life. In the International Journal of Biological Sciences, from the French studies, which, let's see, this one was last reported 2009, three GMO new side effects that they linked to the GMO maize, which is corn consumption, were kidney, liver, and dietary detoxifying organs. They often affected the heart, the adrenal glands, the spleen, the blood system. The renal toxicity was found, possibly due to the new pesticide, and they had high allergic reactions. And these were found in these studies from the International Journal of Biological Sciences, and the French are standing by it. Now, the Swedes have stood by it, and these are respected scientists who are saying, you're not going to bully us into making our people sick.
Oh, Simon, do you know what the reaction of Monsanto has been to all of this? And I love this quote. They basically say the Europeans are very emotional.
Well, that's not an emotional study. These are serious studies. When you look at the number, again, of how many heart patients, how many dialysis per year, how many, you know, organ transplants. And, again, it's the detoxifying organs that are the major part of what's being affected.
Well, but, Ashley, my point was a little different. My point is, if the best argument you have when science proves you wrong is to say that scientists are emotional, it really doesn't speak very much for the argument you're making. And to date, the responses from them have been really borderline childish, if not stupid, because the truth is they know the truth, and the truth is that this is not good for people who eat these kind of foods. But rather than address the key issues, they try to diffuse it by going in another direction.
But I also think part of that diffusion comes from Monsanto and these major corporations. And it's not just Monsanto, because Monsanto's partnered up with the United States. Monsanto's partnered up with Dow, creating a new GMO that's even worse called stacking genes. There's 8 new genes added to this.
It's called stacks.
Oh, my gosh, it's horrible.
So,
but
Simon,
you
were trying to say something. What were you trying to say?
Well, I don't want to get into a long conversation about the Constitution. It's fairly well established that church and state, are two different entities, and they both deserve to be run independently. What I'm hearing, though, is that government is becoming an extension of large corporations. Monsanto wants to sell GMO seeds, in Europe or wherever, and the government is just acting like little lapdogs, going, okay, well, we'll put some pressure on France. We'll put some pressure on Spain. And that isn't what government is supposed to be doing.
Well, let me change it. It's not that they're lapdogs. There are many politicians that are elected with an agenda. Certainly, there's no greater example than the Tea Party. Now, these people have an agenda, and that agenda is to destroy the structure of our government. And that's what they want to do. If they can't do it directly, they want to do it by choking off funds. There are a variety of states under Republican control that are choking off family rights in terms of rights to abortion by merely cutting down the funding, which, they have a right to do. But that's still a technique.
How about Iowa? Iowa right now, they're choking off their funding so that EPA will not have money to take care of and handle the toxic waste that's being dumped into the water system that is so destroyed in Iowa. And it's because they are now choking off their funding. There's a law that they're trying to pass right now in Iowa.
Yep.
Get rid of the EPA.
So there are various ways to attack all this, but they're basically attacking all this. So it's not that they're lapdogs, it's the agenda that they have. The problem, as I point out, with the Tea Party particularly, is they're not considering the consequences. They are so certain they're right, but yet you look at these guys, and I joked with Ashley when they first stood up in Congress, the 100 of them, and had that photo taken that everybody publicized. I said to Ashley, look at them in about a year. They'll all be gray and weary and upset because guess what? They have no clue what's coming. They think they can just show up and change the entire country in a way that'll fit into what they want to do. And life doesn't work that way in the United States. So they're in for a long, tough battle over these issues. And I want to make it clear, I agree with the Tea Party in a great many issues. But at the same time, I balance that with recognizing that we have serious issues in this country that have to be dealt with, Medicare, the elderly, a variety of other things. I listened to my parents' generation talk about the Depression. I listened to what they went through, how they felt about it, how they suffered, and how FDR basically saved their life. And yet, I have friends of mine who have the same political persuasion, the Tea Party, and one of them recently spent a whole lunch telling me what a bad president FDR was and how he ruined this country. And I said to one of them, you weren't even there. How would you know? What makes you think that he ruined this country when everybody who lived there basically said he saved them? And the limited number of people who opposed him, which were primarily Charles Lindbergh and his movement, were also, by the way, supported the Nazis, were just basically wrong and proved to be wrong. And yet, we're involved in a period of revisionist history where people are going in the government, most of them young, naive, with no real knowledge or education, trying to tell everybody how to run this country, and they're wrong. So anyway, that's my political speech of the day.
I'm still bothered that a large corporation can have any kind of influence over elected officials. Now, I know the reason. It's called lobbying. It's all about money. But there's something that just doesn't sit very well with me.
Well, we're in the Gordon Gekko greed is good generation, if you watch the movie Wall Street. And I think it has influenced so many young people who went to college and got out. And, you know, when I went to law school because I loved the law and I wanted to be a lawyer. Kids now go to law school because it's a choice where they can make more money than they can doing something else in life. That is a horrible reason to become a lawyer. It just appalls me. If you don't love and believe in the professional law, you should not be in it.
Well, it's about our democracy and how to help people. I mean,
but the same can be said of that. Also, I noticed a trend that people don't talk much about. I represent a lot of larger corporations, and when I dealt with pharmaceutical and other corporations, which wasn't a lot in my career, I couldn't help but notice that all of them were run by doctors. I worked for Cutter Laboratories coming out of college for a while, but not in the drug field, but international marketing. And the company was run by Dr. Rob Cutter, who was the son of one of the founders. And it was a company that was interested in the welfare of its clients and the medical interests, first and foremost. Now all these companies are being run by MBAs and other people like that who really have no interest and no real knowledge and understanding of what the patient does. Some of them never even been in a hospital, know very little about the drugs they manufacture, and yet they make decisions every day about what drugs you take and how you lead your life. That is scary.
It all boils down to money, though, and but the whole lobbying movement. I read a statistic about the number of lobbying firms registered in Washington, D.C. I mean, doesn't anyone else live in Washington but lobbyists?
No. You're either, of course... Anyone who's been to our nation's capital knows how small it is, but the fact is, no. Basically, Washington, D.C. is a city of lobbyists and politicians. Sadly, some of them never go home because they're too busy in the capital, lose touch with their constituents, and basically lose touch with what's going on in this world. And that therein lies what people call the Beltway mentality within the downtown D.C. area. So, when these people start telling you what's good for you, it's really a lie, because most of them, for example, look at the pensions. These guys get pensions and medical aid, you know, that are just outstanding. So they want to cut Medicare, but not one of those guys is willing to give up their perks that they get as senators. So you tell me, how can you rely or believe in someone who's doing it to you but not accepting any portion of the blame or participation in the cuts themselves? Because I don't see any senators accepting less benefits. They all accept more. Do you expect any of them to suddenly start giving money back?
No. But, I mean, it goes against the basic philosophy of the founding fathers.
Yes.
Well, I'm not sure they even thought of any of this, but that's a whole other question. It is a problem. But when you talk about separation of church and state, this country has always been about money. And in all fairness to even Thomas Jefferson, who's a god in our country, Jefferson believed that people should not be allowed to vote unless they own property. So right now, if you said that, I can't imagine what the general public would say. And a great many things that Thomas Jefferson believed in were not things that would be acceptable to the American public today. So our founding fathers were basing decisions on events that occurred in their time, which didn't necessarily relate to the events that occur in our time. They certainly could not have projected what's going on today.
No, I'm not saying that, but I do believe that they put forward a pretty decent framework. And I believe that framework is being pushed and pulled in directions that it shouldn't be.
Couldn't agree with him more. This is when the lawyer in me comes out. I'm appalled by the efforts, particularly of this Supreme Court, to twist and turn our Constitution to suit their individual needs. Clarence Thomas, oh my God, their opinions horrify lawyers. And I want to join in something else we haven't talked about. I didn't realize until recently that Justice Kagan had been a Monsanto lawyer. So now we have both Justice Kagan and Justice Thomas who are former Monsanto lawyers on the court. So what's going to happen when these pivotal issues get to the Supreme Court, namely genetically modified foods? I don't think that the American public stands a chance, because their vested interests are to support Monsanto. And don't believe for a moment they've forgotten who got them appointed to the president, the Supreme Court.
Well, they probably still believe in it. I mean, you know, it's just, don't you think they still believe in their product?
Well, I don't know.
Even if they just blindfold themselves to the truth of the science?
Well, I don't know when a lawyer truly believes in his product or he's getting paid, to be perfectly honest with you. Lawyers, like everyone else, have families to feed, and when people offer them big checks, they have a duty to represent and do the best they can for their client, which doesn't always entail believing what their clients do. If that were true, then there'd be no criminal lawyers in the United States.
But you're not saying the judges are taking money. You're just saying because at one point they took money from these companies to get them to do what? What happened next then?
I mean, do what? They were their lawyers. So the question is, who contributed to their campaigns? Who lobbied the president of the United States to appoint them? I mean, you start looking at this, and the answer will come back each time. The corporations who saw a benefit in having these people on the Supreme Court, when and if their matters came up before the Supreme Court for review. I mean, please.
Shouldn't they recuse themselves, though? Shouldn't they not be? But isn't that one of the big problems right now with Justice Clarence?
Thomas, yes.
He did not recuse himself and has not been recusing himself on anything of Monsanto.
Right, right. And as a matter of fact, there's a great many articles written by learned scholars about his refusal to recuse himself from the Monsanto litigation. So, yes, that is a major problem, and not only with him, but with others. There's a history of this problem in the United States, justices refusing to recuse themselves. I saw something very strange involved with the case as a witness in Ohio, because one of my clients had passed away, and I'm being forced to testify. So, in the course of it, I found out that the judge who's sitting in the case got a DUI, a drunk driving. Well, that's not that uncommon. It happens to judges, too, and they're no longer being... I mean, the old days, someone would have driven them home. Now you can't do that. They arrest them. So who does he hire? He hires the same law firm that represents the plaintiff in the lawsuit before him involving this person's estate. So now you've got a judge who's accepting money or paying money to a law firm who's representing him, who coincidentally is before him on other issues. When he was asked to recuse himself, he refused. I mean, that's frightening.
Okay. I don't want to get into a constitutional argument, but...
I think you did.
Yes, I did.
Like it or not, you asked the question.
Right. I mean, it was just one of my
That was a great question, Simon. I think it's one that needs to be answered.
I mean, should appointment to the Supreme Court be a lifetime appointment for the very reasons that you've mentioned?
Well, number one, yes, it should be, because it takes it out of the political branch. What was intended by our forefathers was to prevent it from being political. So at the end of the day, and in many respects, it has become more political. And the same could have been said about even John Marshall, our first Supreme Court justice, who in his own way was a very political person. So I don't think it's possible in our country, in our present atmosphere, for anyone to divorce politics from anything anybody does. It's just not in the cards. But at the same time, I believe that we have to have a better way of selecting the justices. I'll give an example. In law school, there's two jokes that stick in your mind. Is what's the definition of a judge in California or any other state? And that definition is a friend of the governor. Because if you're not a friend of the governor, you're not likely to be appointed. Well, in California, they created blue ribbon panels to try to stop some of this, but it still goes on. You always find there's some relationship between a governor and whoever's being appointed. So it starts at every level. Guys are appointed to the bench because of their relationship with the person who appoints them, and there's nothing we can do to change in our country this basic concept, but I wish we could.
Okay, the Supreme Court is a very, very political arena, and, you know, Democrat, Republican, it doesn't matter who's in office. If a position comes up, they want to put someone friendly to that side in a, you know, on the court.
Right. And by the way, no one is exempt from this. You may not realize with your British background that even FDR tried to pack the court, to use an expression, and he did it by trying to pass a law that would expand the size of the Supreme Court up to, I think it was, another four or five justices, which would have allowed him to appoint four or five people to the Supreme Court, and then, of course, change the balance by appointing people who agreed with his philosophy. So every president in some way has tried to affect the decisions of the Supreme Court that way.
It's hard
it just
for me.
Bothers me.
Sorry.
It just bothers me, that's all.
Well, it should.
I don't understand, though, Manny. If you were a judge, and you, because with your clients, when you were doing a lot of legal work, you became close to your clients. You had to, in order to know what was happening and to help them the best way you could. So then, as you're saying, okay, then you go on to become the Supreme Court judge. Let's say we're giving an example. And so now this particular person shows up in your courtroom. You know them so well inside out, and you would be ethically bound to recuse yourself. Why is there no ethics permitted at the Supreme Court, or why can't there be some law, or what is it that they can do to protect that?
Well, first of all, it's a separate branch of the government, and any change to the Supreme Court requires a constitutional amendment to be ratified by 2/3 of the states. Well, I don't think you can get the time of day ratified by 2/3 of the states, personally, and especially now. And I'll give you an example. The Women's Rights Amendment languished for 20-some years before they just junked it and gave up. So, you know, basically our country now has reached a point, and some of it's our population, because some of this occurs when your population of a country gets so large that you literally have so many different divergent views. So size has become a big issue in our country, and it's had an extremely detrimental effect on our democracy, as has immigration. It was first witnessed in the 20s when the increase of the Irish and Italian immigration reached a point where it affected voting. And that's what's going to happen now, is that increased immigration and other things are changing the basic format of the way our government is run. And I'm not criticizing or making a negative statement about anyone in this country, but the fact is they bring different and new views that have to be factored into the daily operation of your country. And I think over time, each particular group that's moved to the United States has established themselves and done it politically by running for office in ways that really have helped our country. But during that process of change comes this issue, namely different versions, viewpoints, and difficulty passing certain laws.
Do you think it's a separation of the states, too? Because that seems to be really huge right now, where you can see when we were talking to people from JFAN and dealing with Iowa or dealing with people in Florida, Minnesota with certain issues, when we were dealing with these different issues, it's almost as if the states have become so independent of the federal government.
Well, if we get into states' rights, we're talking about the Civil War. And recently we revisited Ken Burns' wonderful documentary on the Civil War. And as I've said to Ashley throughout the years, the Civil War is not over. The South still has views uniquely theirs. Recently, Florida, because of its anti-federalist position right now, refused to grant monies from the federal government that California actually was rewarded with, because a lot of the money went to California, and I think it was also Illinois and some others. So some things haven't changed. When you look at some of the positions of the Tea Party, they're reminiscent of states' rights issues that were the primary issues in the Civil War. So for many, the Civil War is not over. The beliefs have been passed down from one family to another, and some families are still flying the flag of Dixie. You see it all the time there, and that's their prerogative, and I really don't care one way or another. I'm not someone who believes it should be taken down. It's part of our heritage. But the fact remains, it's symbolic of their political beliefs, and which they're entitled to, and I completely support. But at the end of the day, it emphasizes exactly what our problem is in our country. Too many divergent viewpoints with too many people.
Indeed. And Manny, I can't resist saying this. I mean, I had a feeling that I knew your hot button, and I think I found it.
Yeah, it is. It's a lawyer's hot button. I'm deeply concerned with what I see as a return to the policies that caused the Civil War.
Well, we're not talking war.
No, we're not
emphasizing
war.
Emphasizing it or anything like that. No.
We have a Civil War right now. We have a war in which a significant number of Americans disagree with it.
It's a verbal war.
Yeah, of course it is, Ashley.
Okay.
You don't need to do that.
Well,
it's a war of words over policies in our country and beliefs that Americans feel are essential to the survival of our country, okay? Now, that war of words is a very critical war of words, because that war of words addresses the very concepts of our democracy. So the question is, do you want less government spending, less government involvement, which worries me to the extent, because less government involvement in health issues particularly are a grave danger to our country, as evidenced by all the food recalls and all the other problems we're experiencing. So we need to balance the need for very important factors in our country to be maintained, health, welfare, the CDC, the EPA, and other things that cannot be ignored. And people in these various groups, particularly the Tea Party and others, need to sit down and balance how they affect the health of Americans every day and be a little more concerned about the welfare of senior citizens and other people whose rights they appear to be trying to destroy. So I think that that's the problem. And, yes, as a lawyer, does it bother me? Yes, I'm worried about our country, and I have good reason to be worried about our country.
Well, what is the solution? All right, I'll cut to the chase. Manny, if you could wave a magic wand, how would you wave it?
Well, the first way to wave it is improved education, because I believe that a lot of things that people are making mistakes about in our country are lack of historical education. General Santayana once said, those who fail to learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat them. And when I look at a lot of these naive Tea Party senators going off to Washington to change the world, I feel that most of them have not read history and don't understand our history. And a lot of things they say and do have been proven wrong by our history. So while they are selectively quoting the Constitution, most of which they don't understand, because the Tea Party essentially is named after the Boston Tea Party, and that's why they paraphrase their name. But when you read their actions, you don't believe they know one thing about the Boston Tea Party. And it's not me alone. I've seen a number of articles, even recently, by people who by you know bright American scholars who feel the same way. They analyze the Tea Party's platforms and go, well, wait a minute, that doesn't relate to the Boston Tea Party. What are you guys thinking? So, yes, first of all, what's happened is the end of Operation Head Start. Minorities particularly are not prepared for school. It's one of the reasons why school statistics are as awful as they are. And we need to go back to start educating children when they're young. One of the differences between the gap between education, between minorities and the upper class is the fact that those families in what is so-called upper class spend a great deal more time educating their children. Granted, they may have more time, but the fact is, and maybe it's because they're also better educated in the long run because they've been given that opportunity. And the problem is we've taken that opportunity away from people. So anyway, I've already said too much.
Okay, I'm actually in total agreement. I read statistics about the current state of education. Everyone likes to think that the U.S. is the leader, if you will, but we're not. We're way down the pack. And what's the problem? Why?
Let me differentiate that for a moment with you. We have a battle going on in Los Angeles over the issues of public schools. I see it all the time on the news about, oh, this and that, and the public schools and teachers have got to be fired because they're not pulling their weight.
Oh, just yesterday alone, I think it was like 180, whatever, I might be quoting the wrong number, of teachers being fired from this one school, $4 million gone for another school. They're cutting out education with music, which is really important for children. And they're cutting out other very basic, important phys ed. I mean, they're cutting out important issues for kids.
Well, let's understand what this is really about. This is about the inner cities. And the reality is that most Americans who have lead an advantaged life do not allow their children to go to school in public schools. So when you see the statistics about how these public schools are failing, the statistics are really saying we are failing to provide an education to minorities because the country really doesn't want to. Well, that's not a good decision at all because guess what? That increases welfare. Among other things, it increases medical costs. So it contributes to higher teenage pregnancies. The list is just so long, I can't imagine it. And for all these people who are against abortion, which I personally am myself, do you need to take into consideration that people are not being educated? So you want to stop this child from having an abortion, yet you've taught that child nothing, which is one of the reasons why pregnancies are occurring so much more, is a lack of education.
Teenage pregnancies, it's very high.
Right, so those are some of the problems. But if you go to the advantage areas, I live in a more advantaged area, and the schools in San Fernando Valley, for example, have dominated the national contests of these decathletes, these school decathlons that they have for learning decathlons. Well, if you look at it, the schools in San Fernando Valley where I live have won something like 11 out of the last 20, and that's from national competitions. So it all has to do with minority areas, and every school that we saw this week, they're having these problems in Los Angeles. We're in minority areas, right?
Absolutely.
So, Simon, we had a show to do, which we never really got
to. No, I was all ready to do foodborne illnesses because I'm looking forward to it, actually.
Well, we're going to do that next week. So, for all our listeners, we're going to write a very interesting blog on the percentages of foodborne illnesses, which actually has proved to me are directly related to many of our problems, and we've also put one on that was out on statistics of the various diseases we've discussed, which can be read on Blogger News or on our site, which is howtoeliminatepain.com, and you can take a look at why we think these numbers are affecting America so much, because, you know, you can hide from a lot of things, but you can't hide from numbers. So,
you know, I do apologize, because I did allow the program to get completely off topic. However, I want to personally thank both of you. I think what we talked about today is incredibly important. It may not be directly related to health and nutrition, but, you know, when you sit back and look at the bigger picture, yes. This
I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, but this is the root cause.
Yes, I agree. And by education, by improving the knowledge that goes to younger children in a wider area, teaching health in school, teaching government in school.
Phys ed has to be there.
You know, but really, well, that would cure the phys ed, because if you teach health,
yes.
That's part of phys ed. So if you want to change this world, change the way you educate your children. And that's been a rule for centuries. So on that note, Simon, we're going to say goodbye within a reasonable time and not go over, and so you're not going to be screamed at by that little computer that haunts you.
Right. Manny and Ashley, I really, really want to thank you for taking time out today to talk with us. I think it was a hugely, hugely informative program.
Well, and listeners, tune in next week when we really get to some interesting food issues and wrap up this conversation and show you how they relate to the food you eat. Because, frankly, they do, and how it relates to your health, which it does.
And millions of people who have foodborne illnesses that don't even know they have had it. So that's an important issue that I'd really like to get to next week.
You can guarantee it. Same bat time, same bat channel. We'll be back again next Saturday.
Same bat guana, too.
Same bat guana, yes.
Thank you, listeners. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.